The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Colombia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. It's me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Mompox, Bolivar, Colombia. This is Colombia Calling, and I'm here in the hot, sweaty, sultry Caribbean region of Colombia. And on this episode 205, I'm speaking on the line to an author all the way away in Australia, Sydney, Australia. Could you imagine that? Well, not the first Australian, not the first person I've had on the line from Australia, but it's always so exciting to know that you can connect with people all the way over the world. I've had some feedback on episode 204 about the páramos, the high altitude biomes in Colombia, and it's been incredibly positive indeed. So thank you for that feedback. Getting to sit down with three academics and talk about páramos was certainly a challenge, but was always going to be interesting. And they were able to, let's say, tone down the academic side of things to speak to the likes of you and me about one of Colombia's most incredible sceneries. Well, of course, a country that is just basically spoilt for choice when it comes to scenery and when it comes to nature, but at the same time, it was pretty incredible. So, without further ado, let me say that I'm on the line to Sydney, Australia, with Kelly Brooke Nichols, who's an author but has a long history in Colombia. Her book came out in June of 2017. It's called A Reluctant Warrior. You can find it on Amazon. There are some incredibly good reviews there. And she got in touch with us, and she got in touch with Columbia Calling about talking about Columbia and talking about her book. So welcome on Columbia Calling, Kelly.
Thank you so much. I'm really stoked to be here.
No, it's a real pleasure to have you on the line and to have you on the show. Kelly, I think we should start from the very beginning. How did you end up in Columbia?
Yeah, well, so I was working with the UN independent expert on minority rights, and she got me to do research about when I first started working for her, and I was eager as, and she said, right, do you want to research Law 70 about the Afro-Colombians? I had absolutely no idea what she was talking about, but, you know, I was young and eager, and I was like, yeah, of course, and, you know, acted like I knew what she was talking about. She went away, and I proceeded to Google Law 70 plus Afro-Colombians and find out it was, you know, the main law in Colombia protecting the Afro-Colombians. And so I did research for her, and subsequently I met some really inspiring Afro-Colombian human rights defenders and a lot of really incredible people in Washington as well who were doing work on the subject. And I got in it that way, and I got a university grant to do research, and I had really become fascinated with the Afro-Colombian culture and the plight, and so I decided to use that grant to go to Colombia. And I started off in Colombia researching the African palm oil industry and like displacement of Afro-Colombians, and then I got a job from there with COLES, which is probably the biggest national organization that works on displacement.
Incredible. What an incredible and also, I imagine, quite moving situation to be dropped into, because, of course, the plight of the Afro-Colombians, if we're not just the Caribbean coast, but, of course, the Chocó of Colombia are just hugely overlooked. I'm sure you traveled extensively in those areas.
Yeah, I really, like, looking back in hindsight, I was so blessed as a foreigner to... because of my work, so for COLES, I was part of this group that was looking at basically the impact of the war on minority groups, and I was focused on Afro-Colombians and my colleagues on Indigenous and women and children, and I was just really, really blessed to travel throughout the Pacific, obviously, because the Afro-Colombian population is throughout the Pacific, throughout the Caribbean, around Magdalena, very extensively, to places that foreigners would just probably not think to go at. I really got to immerse myself in the culture and the plight and just beautiful people. And I felt very, very blessed.
It's interesting this, because one of the first times I came to Colombia back in 1998, I was sent by WWF, the environmental NGO, down to the Pacific coast to travel basically between just a bit further, by Malaga to Buenaventura by boat. Honestly, despite the obvious aggressions and dangers and problems, it still to this day has left such I got hooked. The people were so infectiously wonderful. And I've never looked back on that. I've never thought about it in a negative fashion, despite everything. I've always thought about, despite everything, these people are just, they're living their lives and they take you in as one of their own. Despite me looking completely different, despite my culture being completely different, I really found it to be just otherworldly in that sense. And of course, you've spent so much around that, and this has been what you've based your book on, really.
Yeah, but I totally agree with you with that sort of just falling in love with the Afro-Colombian culture. And obviously, my book deals with very heavy issues, and it's a thriller and so forth. But everyone who reads it always says, "I can really see how you love the culture," because I try to bring out as much as possible that the Afro-Colombian culture, the sense of family, like the broader sense of family and community, the connection to land, the connection to the environment. Like, I love the traditional medicine, obviously the music. The music's brilliant. The food, everything, yeah. And also just, my experience in general, not just with the Afro-Colombians, because after that I was the executive director of the U.S. Office of Colombia, so I worked with all sorts of amazing human rights defenders across Colombia for 3 years, after the initial work I did. And the thing, I had this ongoing experience in Colombia where on one moment I would just be overwhelmed by the kind of violence I saw, but that's, because for my job, I was working in there. And so, and seeing very clearly the paranoia, the guerrilla violence. And then I would meet these like incredible people that were so brave and would stand up to that violence and risk their life. Many human rights defenders, as you know, have been killed. And it just always blew me away. And so I always have that experience of kind of moving between it, almost feeling of despair, because like how can there be this kind of violence, to just a feeling of real awe and inspiration at the people, by the people. And that's really why I wrote my book. A Reluctant Warrior was to shine a light on the impact of the war, because I think it's important that it's talked about, especially now that they've signed the peace agreement. But more than that, I really wanted to celebrate all those brave human rights defenders across Colombia. And many of them have lost their lives, and so I just wanted to try and write a book that celebrated them.
No, wonderful. Wonderful that you should be able to do this, and wonderful that, you can take, I have to say, you take time, you step away from Colombia, and perhaps that helps you reflect on it better to be able to write about it. Is that something that that came across? I mean, being in Australia and remembering, maybe your memories are more vivid from far away.
I don't know. It was a very long process. I started writing the book. I had the idea for the book very early on in 2007. Because like I said, for my work, I was lucky. My work was literally traveling all the time, interviewing Afro-Colombian displaced people. And I think all up, I probably, probably more than hundreds. I would say it's in the thousands now of people, because there were so many. I was constantly doing it. And just people's stories started to really get to me. And this, the idea for Luzma, who's the main character in my book, an Afro-Colombian woman who's displaced from her community and who kind of her brother gets mixed up into the paramilitary, so her 12-year-old brother, I should say, and her story of like fighting for justice and what's right and so forth, it came to me kind of organically, and for about a year there, it was in my mind. It got so bad that I would be in meetings, in Colombia, and I'd be thinking, yeah, I think Luzma would say that, or she'd do that. And then finally, I was like, if I don't write this thing, I'm going to go crazy because I have this voice in my head. But it took me a long time to write. So I had the experience, which I think I was lucky, of starting it in Colombia. Then I was in DC, so I was very involved in the politics and everything of Colombia. I was traveling constantly. But then when I was at the editing process was when I then moved back to Australia and I got a job here to be closer to my family. And so I did the editing from a further, so I was physically further away. So I don't know if that helped or it was a hindrance, I'm not sure.
It's fascinating though, and it's giving me some hope because, I mean, you say you had the idea back in 2007 when you moved to Colombia, so you know a good 10 years from idea to actually, published final work, and wonderful final work it is too. It gives me hope because I keep struggling with my own manuscript. So do we all have a book?
I really think that for something like that, that as big as writing a book, because it is a really big thing, you have to believe so strongly in your own dream, because it takes a lot of time and it takes a lot of, you know, it's not like I wrote to one publisher and I got published.
Yeah.
I had to write to a lot of agents, a lot of publishers before it got picked up, and it really takes that tenacity. And it's the same once a book is published. It's not like you publish a book and overnight it becomes a bestseller. Well, I know, maybe, you know, a random three or four people. But the vast majority of us have to work our ass off over time to make a book a success. So you really have to believe in it. Over time.
Well, of course, hence you're here on Columbia Calling. You know, you're reaching out to the far out there podcast for the niche market to appeal to people who love Columbia.
Exactly.
And of course, I'm appreciative of this. Now, I'm curious, and of course, in the next segment of the show, we will delve further into the book itself. But, I mean, you traveled around a lot. You worked in human rights and minority rights. Were you ever under threat? Did you ever receive direct threats from any of the armed groups or even, let's say, the government side of things?
Yeah, there's two times in Colombia. I mean, a tourist, I've been robbed, but that's no big deal.
No.
There's two times that I felt directly threatened. One was when I was then, it was the second time I was in Colombia. I was working in the U.S. Office in Colombia, and my colleagues and I put out a report about, remember the DEA scandal?
Yeah.
DAS scandal.
DAS, yeah.
And so we put out a pretty damning report that called on the links to the government, and the then president went on radio and called my colleagues and I FARC sympathizers, as you know. And then 2 days later, I was traveling all around the country. So it's, you feel a bit, self-aware of your protection when you're traveling around in rural areas and you've been named by the president as a FARC sympathiser, which I am definitely not.
Well, he comes out and says that the former president now, but of course he comes out and says that a fair bit. I mean, the stigma that surrounds being, let's say, liberal or even slightly left of center means that they just get to call you a FARC sympathizer, like the worst thing possible, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's definitely not a label that you want when you're traveling. But and the only other time that I felt quite nervous was I was doing some work in Chocó. I was going down river down the Atrato, and I was with a delegation, but at the time there was it was being fought over by the FARC, by two different paramilitary groups, by the military. We passed all of them, but we were in a delegation, and then we were meant to come back the same day, and the motor broke down, and it took them hours to fix it, and by the time they had fixed it, it was pitch dark. That was probably the only time I really lost my cool and was like, I am not traveling up a river in the dark. This is being, in the very middle of an armed battle. That's just asking to be killed. So luckily, and this was one of these moments that just beautiful people, these groups of nuns said, no, I don't think you should do that. You just come and stay with us and tomorrow you'll go up. And I went, yep, that's a good idea.
I think
not
that's
being kidnapped today.
Yeah, I think you did very well being swept under the wing of a group of nuns. I think certainly on the Atrato River. In such a difficult part of Colombia, and to this day remains a difficult part of Colombia. I mean, let's not gloss over the fact that a peace accord does not end so much of the problems, inequity, and needs in Colombia. It's a serious situation, especially in the Chocó and in that area, of course, as well.
That point that you just made is so important, and it's really good that your listeners hear that. I feel that, especially like Buenaventura, my novel, as you know, is set in Buenaventura, and that is absolutely the case there. Because, yes, if I look at the statistics of violence and I compare them from when I was there in 97 to now, yes, they've improved a lot. The displacement, the homicides, etc., are much fewer today. But as you said, the underlying factors that contribute, that create that violence, like the fact that they have 64% unemployment compared to 9.4% in the overall country, and that a huge percentage of people still don't have access to sewage and running water, and la la la, that fuels the possibility of violence in the future, that kind of structural inequality and racism.
Well, that's it, isn't it? And it comes down to that, the base, I think, racism that is presented, especially, of course, in areas like Buenaventura, Tumaco, and other cities and towns across the Pacific coast. We're going to take a short break right now and come back with Kelly, Kelly Brook Nichols, and we're the author of A Reluctant Warrior. We're going to take a short break and we're going to come back and continue talking about Colombia with her and, of course, her experiences, and delve a little bit more into her book. I don't want to give her book away, of course, because you should be buying it, and it's available on Amazon, and you can check out Kelly's website at kellybrooknichols.com. Very easy there. And check, or just put Kelly Brook Nichols into Amazon and it will pop up. That's A Reluctant Warrior. This is Colombia Calling. I'm Richard McCall. This is episode 205, and we'll be back just after these short messages. Thank you very much for listening. And we're back. This is Colombia Calling. I'm Richard McCall here in Mompós. That's up in Bolívar. We're 5 hours inland from Cartagena. For those of you who don't know this jewel in the crown of authentic colonial towns in Colombia, Mompós is different, I think, because it still belongs to Mompósinos. I realize there's an irony of me saying that as the foreigner here in town, but really does. It really does belong to Mompósinos. You come here as a tourist, and I can tell you now, you feel like a pioneer because you see so few other tourists. We're talking to Kelly Brook Nichols on the line from Sydney, Australia. Very exciting to have someone on from Sydney, Australia, and who's taken the time out of her busy schedule to be able to talk to us about her new novel, A Reluctant Warrior. Now, Kelly comes to Colombia Calling, of course, with a vast knowledge of Colombia, having worked and traveled all over the country, working as the U.S. Office on Colombia from Washington, and equally as a human rights, let's say, observer or expert, and an expert in minority rights here in the country. So we've been talking a little bit about her novel and a little bit about the issues that affect Colombia. And, well, we were talking about the Chocó, but you have traveled everywhere around the country pretty much. And I'm sure you've traveled to the Montes de María, Kelly.
Yeah, I didn't spend a lot of time there.
Okay.
I've only been there once. I spent most of my time like throughout the Pacific and the actual Caribbean coast.
Okay.
So I only went once to Montes Medi.
All right. Is it, a particularly troublesome area? Again, today, and I think as you mentioned in the first segment, you were doing, studies or observations or investigations into forced displacements due to the African palm cultivations. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, which is actually why I went to Montes Medi. So basically, the African palm oil, legal, obviously.
Yeah.
But the problem is that it has led to illegal usurpation of Afro-Colombian land. I mean, the Afro-Colombians typically, because of the places where they live, their land is one, more kind of fertile for these sorts of crops, and also, as you know, it's strategic for the illegal crops, and you know that's why they've been so disproportionately affected by the war. And so I witnessed these companies, big companies that would come in and assert the land, often illegally forcing the Afro-Colombians or manipulating them in quasi-legal ways, but clear manipulation. There are mental degradation as well of the African farmer leads to a lot of environmental degradation, which obviously has a specific impact on the Afro-Colombians because by very nature they're so connected to their land, and land is everything, you know, from farming to community, etc., etc. So it has pretty devastating impacts.
Yeah, and I think, this not just talking about the sort of palm oil and the palm oil cultivations, which you see as when you fly over various areas of Colombia, I mean, they extend as far as the eye can see. We're not just talking about the Montes de Maria or the Pacific, but even into Guaviare and other places. And I'm sure out there towards the borders with Venezuela, there are huge things that are sort of out of sight, out of mind. But I sort of think about this connection with the land, and I think about the issues in Colombia, and let's say 53, 54 years of conflict with the FARC guerrillas or with whomever, and I said, you have to tie it to land. I mean, you sort of talk about the Afro-Colombians being connected very much to the land, but also the politics of this country is all about land. And look at the number one issue on the peace negotiations there that concluded last year in Havana, Cuba. It was agrarian reform. I don't see this as a problem that's going to be resolved anytime soon.
Yeah, I know, because, you have such unique inequality in the distribution of land and ownership of land in Colombia. I mean, that's what started the whole war in the first place, when it was actually not just about economics.
Yeah.
So it's key. It should be the number one thing that they deal with. And I really hope the ethnic chapter, where the Afro-Colombians get, clear participation in that reform, assuming that the reform goes ahead, I think that's really important.
Of course, it's incredibly important. Now, these experiences that you had traveling around the country and the many years that you were visiting Colombia and, coming down from Washington or based here full time, I mean, you've taken from these experiences, these direct experiences, and so let's say adapted them to your novel. Can you tell us, a little bit more about that, these connections?
As I mentioned, when I was traveling around the country the first 2 years I lived there, and I was interviewing people who'd been displaced by war, I was just really moved by their stories and really moved by the specific, I was working with people who had loved ones disappeared, and obviously with human rights defenders who was threatened and killed, and all these issues really touched me. And then, I had the idea for the novel, and I wanted to really shine a light on these issues. But I think that people, because the Colombian War went for so long, 52 years, people started to become desensitized to it. And that's definitely the experience I had when I was in Washington and we were trying to advocate to the Congress and trying to get funding for these issues. People were like, they were sick of it. Mm. And so I think that people, once they become desensitized, they turn off and they look at things, from a very removed perspective. And so that's the idea of the book. I co-authored a book, I'm sure there's only five people that have ever read in Spanish, a textbook about the impact of the war on minority groups. But I wanted to try my hand at fiction, because I feel like stories have the power to make people care. Mm. Because you get into a character and you really start to empathize with them, and your barriers are down because, you're not being preached to. You're just engaged in a story, and then at the end you find out, wow, that a lot of the vast majority of what is told in that story is true. And then subsequently, so I came up with the idea for the story, and I knew that I needed I love thrillers myself, so I made it into a thriller, and And I didn't really have the idea for the paramilitary drug cartel bit very elaborated. But at that time, you might remember it back in 2010, when I'd already started working on the book, they discovered the first full-blown Russian-esque submarine that the cartels were using to export drugs. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do remember it.
And subsequently, and around the same time, they were finding several submarines being developed in the jungle not far from Buenaventura. And I just found this fascinating. I was like, this is insane that the cartels have so much money that they can actually build Russian submarines. Yeah. And then I came up with the idea that would be the part of the story, the cartel paramilitary part of the story. So then I got involved in researching the use of submarines and the narco and the trafficking side of things, which I didn't know that much about before, because I was always focused on the human rights side.
No, but it's good to bring this in. And I remember that first time that they were able to establish it. How much money do you need to import Russian engineers to do this? I just think that it's staggering, isn't it? And one of my little anecdotes about that is studying here in Colombia. One of my companions, study companions, is actually a lieutenant or lieutenant in the teniente, I guess they call, in the Navy, and he's a submarine operator, I guess. And so he has to end up being flown out to Buenaventura and Tumaco a lot to then take these crafts and drive them. Because he's a submarine operator, they expect him to know how to drive these, homemade or Russian-built submarines to take them into naval bases. I just think it's really peculiar. And he always says... Yeah, and he just says,
I'd like to speak with your friend. He probably has brilliant stories.
He has great stories and things. He's had to be flown out to the Atrato River to get in some, and he just says, they're not built for human use, you know? You can't breathe in them. I don't know. It sounds pretty terrifying to me, but I'd love to see one with my own eyes. Did you get to see them yourself?
There's only, I saw them in other, not in Colombia, no. When I was then moved to Australia, when I was editing the book, I befriended the head of the Australian Maritime Museum, who himself used to be used to drive submarines, and he's the top Australian expert on submarines. And he reviewed all the submarine part for me. He was very, very helpful because clearly, someone like me, I suppose, Richard, the point is I really wanted to make all the details in the book accurate.
Of course.
I felt that if I made this part inaccurate, then it would undermine my whole kind of aim of doing it, which is to show true facts through a fictitious story. So it was very important to me that everything in it was based in fact. So I did a lot of work with him and trying to get all the description of the building. Even in my book, the specific kind of model and so forth of the submarine is all based on fact and truth.
No, and of course you have to get these things right, because you get one thing slightly inaccurate and you're going to lose your reader if that person knows about it. I can understand that fully. Now, you spoke to is there a guy in the DEA for a while as well to get that side of things right?
He is absolutely incredible. I'm always indebted to Joe Top. Joe used to be the everyone in Colombia probably knows him. He was the longest longest-serving leader of the Colombia office of the DEA. So for those people who are watching Narcos, he basically was the boss of Javier Peña, and Steve Murphy, who I've met, by the way.
Lovely
guys. Joe introduced me to them. But anyway, so for several years, Joe, who'd never actually met me in person, I met the now, or probably former by now, leader of the DEA, and he introduced me to Joe. And over several years, he was so generous. He answered my million questions, and very stupid questions, because again, I'm not a drug enforcement specialist, but I really wanted to get it all accurate. He read all the chapters about drug enforcement. He read, he found me an expert. There's a scene, as you know, where they're putting tracking devices on the submarine. He found me an expert in the DEA who is an expert in tracking devices, who helped me create that. So incredibly, incredibly generous guy.
No, and I think it's great. I think it's excellent. I read and I saw a little bit of the blog that you have with this agent Toft. I mean, excellent, yeah. Excellent. That he should be so accessible and not, selfish with his knowledge. I mean, that's great to be able to get someone of that nature to talk to you. You'd think they would be, keep shtum about their experiences.
Well, I think, you know, Joe did such incredible work in Colombia. That was the time when, I mean, he presided over the time that they brought down obviously led by the Colombian authorities, Pablo Escobar.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose it was the highlight of his career, and he's really happy to talk about those. Yeah.
Well, so you've met the guys from Narcos. We don't need to cover that. but this, you know, this novel, this thriller that you've written, and I read it fast, but I read and I have to say that the thing that really appealed to me at the end, and I find something that maybe needs to be shared with Colombian people, is where you've got your protagonist and she decides not to kill this person. You know, she decides to be, well, I'm giving away the story a little bit.
Yeah, sorry, but, sorry, spoiler alert, spoiler
sorry
alert.
Sorry about that, spoiler alert. But she's, you know, what I like most is that, no, this guy needs to be brought to justice. Now, I just feel in Colombia, so often, justice is obviously, you know, who holds the gun, not through the legal courts. And I find this to be ends up being an impediment to progress here. And what I'm getting at really is that maybe you felt that too, or maybe as a human rights person, you wanted to put that in there.
No, absolutely. A lot of the work that I did, especially when I was then the director of the U.S. Office in Colombia with my colleagues in America, was on impunity.
Yeah.
And, you know, because impunity levels are so high in Colombia, and I just think that whilst there is impunity, how does a society really progress?
Yeah.
Because you need justice for the crimes that have been committed. That was very important to me that was in the story, and I actually had to fight with some editors about that point.
Oh, it's good to know you had to fight with the editors.
Your typical American finishing or whatever.
No, but it's good to hold your ground on this one, and if you've got the backing for it, you know, it's like, listen, this is why I wrote the book, this is what I want to get across, and I'm sure you convinced them, because there it is. So tell me a little bit. Well, I mean, this is a book. Okay, so, you know, for those of you listening, check out kellybrooknichols.com. That's her website. There's blogs on there, interviews and so on. And look up Amazon. You'll find A Reluctant Warrior. It came out in June 2017. But let's talk about Colombia today, because, of course, you've worked excessively on Colombia, so it's not something that's going away. It's something that's very close to your heart. But, I mean, how do you feel now? I mean, a lot of what I would talk about and what I work on is the reality of things as we go forwards to the 2018 elections. I mean, sitting in Australia there, how do you feel? I mean, have you been speaking to contacts, colleagues or friends here in Colombia about the potential for next year?
Yeah, and I always like, when I get a question about modern day Colombia, I always like to temper it first by saying I no longer consider myself, I feel like I can speak with expertise about the time that I worked on Colombia, mm-hmm. because I was, you know, fully involved in it and was living and breathing this.
Mm-hmm.
Now, because I don't, I, like everybody, read the news, but I don't, I'm not as involved with it. So I just always like to say that to start with. But I'm obviously thrilled that there is the peace agreement, but I'm also, you know, I'm cautious, because... Yeah. While you still have those kind of the factors like we talked about, the underlying structural inequality, which I hope has to be dealt with.
Yeah.
Like, it has to be dealt with. And you still have the drug trade. Obviously, it's not like it used to be. It's fragmented, but it's still such a strong force of illegal economies. So you still have all these factors that create violence, and unless they're properly dealt with, I don't know what sort of sustainable peace you have. I mean, I'm not saying that I think the country will be in war again, but like true peace where the lacking of kind of, you know, violent armed groups, that's what I would like to see in Colombia. But to achieve that, you need to deal with the underlying kind of structural issues.
Yeah, no, and I'm completely on board with you. I mean, I celebrate the peace accord, but worry if enough is being done on the other side of things to, like you say, to ensure that, let's say, these overlooked communities are included in Colombian society, because for so long they really haven't been. They've been, you know, there's been the urban-rural divide that I continually talk about, but it seems to be, you know, so marked. And even recently with the, let's say, the Paro Agrario, you know, several years ago, it came into the city, for people to see. This was important. But it's a tough one, isn't it? Especially when you think, I mean, you're far more of an expert in the Pacific Coast than I am. I haven't been in years now, unfortunately. I'd love to go, but life gets in the way. But you know that those areas are strangled by the lack of real communication. And we're not just talking about roads and airports, just real communication and even sort of state presence in terms of health and education and basic human rights, running water, electricity, things like that. These things, these places are strangled. And I don't know how much, you know, when you last might have been in Buenaventura, Tumaco, and these areas, but I doubt they've changed all too much.
I mean, yeah, look at what happened in May with the paro there and the way the government reacted. Instead of actually acknowledging that people are protesting for very good reasons, because, like I said, there's 64% unemployment rate and a huge, I think it's like 400,000 people or something don't have running water. Don't quote me on that. I don't have the stat in front of me, but it's high. And, you know, I remember going there, and so, because I spent a lot of time there, and so many people live in these houses over sewage laden water.
Yeah.
And the unemployment and the lack of, even where there is employment, it's unofficial, insecure employment. And of course people are going to protest. They should protest, as they did in Chocó.
Yeah.
And so the government shouldn't respond to that by sending in ESMAP and, you know, a brutal kind of slapdown. What they should do is deal with those underlying issues. And I mean, it's positive that the government has tried to deal with the violence in Buenaventura, but you can't just deal with, it's like, you know, I don't know, you make a crappy cake and you take off the icing. You've got to deal with the underlying, I think that's probably terrible, but you've got to deal with what's underlying it.
Yeah.
You can't just deal with what you can actually see, so obviously. If you don't deal with the underlying issues, well, then you don't really have sustainable,
And I think,
situation.
Like you say, you know, and the people, they should strike. Now, this is not me calling upon them to strike, but they have the right to strike, and they have the right to demand better living conditions, even the most basic ones. And it's just a tough one. But again, like you said, you mentioned earlier, they become desensitized as well. And so do, I guess, the people in the city. Oh, another article about the troubles in Buenaventura, Tumaco, etc. People just don't really think about it anymore. It's just like, oh, it's always been a problem, right? I mean, how do we get this message across?
Yeah, and I really liked your point earlier about, you know, like the bringing of it to the city, because I think the problem is that peace agreement signed, cities, as long as you don't go out of the immediate area into, I mean, obviously within the cities there's huge huge areas of poverty and insecurity, Alto Azúcar,
yeah,
and areas like that in Bogota, for example. In Medellin and Cali, etc. But it's very easy in Colombia to live in a city and really, these days, not be very aware of the violence and the inequality and everything that continues to happen in your country. And I think for the country to move forward, it needs to be united, and to be united, you need to call what's happening. You know, you need to bring attention to it.
You need to draw, draw some light on it and so on. And I say this almost every week, I go through peaks and troughs here in Colombia, and I love the country, and then suddenly I'm like, oh God. It's never dull. It's got better, but there's so much to do. And these elections coming up in 2018, I mean, I would just say that so much hinges on them, perhaps more than ever before. It troubles me, but at the same time, it's good to know, you know, people like yourself, even a long way away, you care, and you are definitely working for the Colombian people. This story that you've written is to ensure that the knowledge about what has gone on or continues in some places to go on, you've got it out there, and that's the important thing in my mind. So say thank you for, sending me the electronic version so I could read it, because that's the overall, let's say, message that I received.
Thank you. And I've been doing quite a lot of speaking engagements here, and people in Australia ask me, they get moved by the stories, and they say, well, what can we do?
Yeah.
And obviously I point them to organizations like Waller and Log and really good, well, this is people who can't speak Spanish, otherwise I'd to organizations in Colombia, to really good human rights organizations. And but apart from that, I said to them, sharing these issues on social media, the government's very engaged, showing people that more widespread, the more people are talking about the fact that a peace agreement doesn't mean that everything is great, I think is really important. And just shining a light on these sort of issues that we've been talking about is important. And you can do that wherever you are.
That's a great...
Thanks so much, Katie.
So let's wind this down now, and I'll give you another shout out. You can check out Kelly's novel at kellybrooknichols.com, the website, or look it up on Amazon. It's called A Reluctant Warrior. It is a good read, and it does cover so many of the issues in Colombia. There are excellent reviews on Amazon. I'll write one soon enough. Kelly, what do you do with your time now that you're not in Colombia? You're not worrying about the Pacific coast?
Now I'm worried about other areas. I work for Medicine Sans Frontieres.
Okay.
Without Borders, or in Spanish, Medicine Sin Fronteras. Okay. They're actually in Colombia, but I work for them here in Australia. So at the moment, I deal with issues about refugees, looking at the situation now in Myanmar and Bangladesh. Still on these sorts of issues, just different countries.
No, so once a human rights expert, always a human rights expert.
But it's been great to the book to come out and give me this opportunity to get kind of like back involved. And my next thing, in case I have to ask this, just in case any of our listeners know of anyone, my next plight is to try and get the book translated to Spanish.
Oy.
So if by any chance anyone listening knows people who in the I want it in the Latin American publishing industry, not so much the Spanish, because I really would like it focused on it being publicized and so forth.
Okay.
Specifically in Latin America. So if anyone happens to be listening to this and knows, please email me. I would be thrilled beyond belief. Because, that's so important to me. I don't really care about it being translated into any language is great, but I really care about it being translated and published into South America. And if I don't figure it out, the official... I'm just
going
to do it myself.
Okay. Well, no, I might have a contact or two, so we'll talk about this anon. And I expect your next book to come out about the Bangladeshi or refugees or the ones from Myanmar.
I don't know. I have an idea for a non-fiction book next, but I've got to get to time. I have two young kids, a full-time job, and a book to promote. A lot.
All right. Well, listen, Kelly, thank you so much for your time and getting in touch with us and agreeing to come on the podcast and to speak so frankly about a region and a people who clearly you have, more than just a superficial affection for. It's something that's really, I guess we could say, is under your skin. I mean, you feel for Colombia and you feel for the Afro-Colombian population. So again, another shout out to this is Kelly Brook Nichols. You can find her website, kellybrooknichols.com. The novel is called A Reluctant Warrior, and it's on Barnes & Noble, Amazon, and anywhere else you should be able to get your books from. Kelly, thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you. I had a great time chatting to you.
It's always fun. It's always fun. That's the idea here. Anyway, so this has been episode 205. I'm Richard McCall. This is Columbia Calling. I know you've enjoyed this show because whenever we get someone on who can talk with a fluency about what they are passionate about, really, it makes a difference, doesn't it? So, and send your emails, as always, columbiacalling@gmail.com. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. You will find links to Kelly's book on the Facebook page, of course, and take a read. You know, we've got to help one another out in this world. So that's me signing off for today. Thank you again for listening. Bye-bye.